Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
So today's speaker, Phil Verlegger, is going to tell us about what in the world happened in oil markets this summer and what we might be able to do to prevent that from happening again. I followed Phil for many years. He earned his PhD at MIT and began his career teaching at Yale. He's also served time on the President's Council of Economic Advisors, the U.S. Treasury, Institute for International Economics, and the University of California. He's a member of the National Petroleum Council and the Council of Foreign Relations, and he's written over 100 books and articles on energy economics. And he doesn't just talk about energy economics and energy markets. He's been an active participant. He was telling me this morning he's taken the market test and he's passed it in his current capacity as president of PK Verlegger LLC and senior advisor to the Brattle Group. He's been frequently asked to testify before Congress on issues of regulation, taxation, market behavior, and mergers. And so it's a great pleasure to welcome Phil Verlegger.
Thank you very much, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here. I should add that I need to update my thing. I am now the David Mitchell and Canna Professor of Strategy at the University of Calgary. And I left teaching, went to Drexel Burnham, and then created a little business to talk about oil markets. And as I said, I've passed the market test, I guess, because people, oil companies have continued and consumers have come to me for 20 years now to talk about oil prices. But why Calgary? In case you hadn't noticed, there's a lot of oil up in Canada, and they'd like to sell it. And a friend of mine, who's now the dean of the business school, is a classmate at MIT, came and said, look, there's no town in the world that's more boom or bust than Calgary. First, and when we got up there, it was really great, and now they're looking and saying, what the heck has happened? Now, I'm a fourth-generation Californian, so I know a lot about boom and bust societies, having been through this place and having grown up. My father was the first clerk for the very famous Supreme Court justice here, and we watched California go through the cycles. I'm a long-term admirer of Jim's work, and I think I first really started to understand the macro relationships when I started to read him. I studied econometrics, a different form, and nobody has done a better job of really describing the macro linkages. He has a good paper out, which I gather is now going to come out in the Energy Journal, called Understanding the Oil Cycle, and he makes three points. First, that oil price cycles tend to be permanent. Second, that they're difficult to predict. And third, that they're driven by different factors. You can go into the details, but those are the things. I disagree with two of those points. Academics always disagree with two of the points. Professional consultants do. They are not necessarily permanent. If you look at 150 years of oil prices, real oil prices, going back from 1860 through today and then kind of extrapolated, what you find is that the real price of oil has tended, at least as reported in the BP Statistical Yearbook, which is our source, to hang around $20 in 2007 prices with spikes. Now, I put on a spike what would have happened in World War II had we not had rationing. We had rationing. It did bind. Had we not had it, we would have had it. We had the 80 spike. And I put out there something like 2020, another spike. We had one in 2008 and 1980. It's also possible to predict them to a certain extent. I wrote papers in 2005, 2004, saying it was going to go to 60 when it was 30. I wrote a paper in January of 2006, and it was published in the International Economy, which is a magazine the few of you see that you should get. It's got most of the contributors to are people like Marty Feldstein, myself, Ken Rogoff, and others. And I laid out the case for $100 oil. And I said it was environmental regulations. We were going there. And everybody said, no, we're not. Pat you on the head. Go away. Well, we did. What Professor Hamilton is exactly right about is that different factors govern oil prices. And over the years, as you look at it, you find every time you think you understand this market, something has changed. When you talk to younger economists, and I used to be a young economist, and you look at data, okay, we put together the data set, and then we model it. So I was talking to a young economist recently. He said, well, I have now 35 years of monthly oil price data, so I can model it. And I'm reminded of a line that a friend of mine used when he taught econometrics, and I taught it years and years ago when I understood the subject. Bad data are not just torn IBM cards. Now, it was a great line until students didn't understand what IBM cards were. I will explain that we have moved into a situation now where we have four hydrocarbons in the world, not three. Traditionally, you think of coal, natural gas, and crude oil as the three hydrocarbons. Thanks to environmental regulations, and there's no place in the world that people have a better understanding of environmental regulations than California, we now have four: coal, natural gas, sweet crude, and sour crude. And sour crude is what Saudi Arabia produces. It's what's abundant in the world and what is at a large and often unusable. So this summer, when we were dealing with $140 oil, there were ships full of sour crude sitting in the Persian Gulf. The world demand was 86 million barrels a day of consumption, and there were 6 million barrels a day of unused productive capacity. And it couldn't be used, at least the prices that were set. That gets to the other point, that in the oil market, there is a cartel. It's really a monopoly. It operates very much the way De Beers used to operate in the diamond market. The manager is Saudi Arabia, and they limit the availability of sour crude to the market to keep prices of sour crude from collapsing. Now, that has two effects. One, it keeps up the price of sour crude. And two, it prevents and discourages companies from investing to process the sour crude into products we need. And in particular, the product we need is low sulfur diesel fuel. Going forward, what we're going to need is low sulfur fuel to power ships. And sometime between, if you look out there, I put 2020 with a question mark, between 2012 and 2020, we're going to have another major spike in oil prices because we are going to need sweet crude to make low sulfur fuel for ships, and we won't have it. So prices will go way up. And I was reassured this morning to find out that, in fact, my faith that oil prices do affect economic growth was still correct. I mean, the data still support the view that this recession was partially caused by high oil prices. We'll get another recession, probably just after we come out of the current depression. The key problem is most crude oil has a lot of sulfur. And what I'm going to set this up in terms of is ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel. This graph shows, and I just did it this morning, grabbed it from another presentation, so the black doesn't show very well, cumulative distribution of world crude by sulfur content. Going up the vertical axis, you have cumulative oil production, and going as high as 60 million barrels a day. This is all the data we have for the crudes. There's a lot more out there. And going across horizontally is the percent. And the vertical line is 0.5%. Why 0.5%? You really need crude oil with less than 0.5% sulfur to make low sulfur diesel. What has happened was in 2000, the US EPA issued rules requiring that all diesel fuel used over the road have 10 part per million sulfur or less, beginning in 2006. And in 2003, the EU issued rules requiring the same by 2009. And what that does is mean that refiners either have to put in very expensive hydrotreaters and desulfurization capacity to remove the sulfur from crude or buy low sulfur crude. And the US industry adjusted. The European industry didn't get there in time, and they're not getting there now. At the same time, demand increased. So what happened was we had everybody needing ultra-low sulfur crude oil to make ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel, or building the hydrotreaters. And last year, we had a collision between supply and demand. What happened is we had growth in Europe. The European economy expanded. They added 12 new members to the EU in 2006. Now, when I gave this talk and explained this to a group of students, or that you tend to have many students from Eastern Europe in Europe, in Calgary, and they all said, well, but we knew this was coming. Well, they did know this was coming. They did know the 12 new members were going to join. What they didn't anticipate was that German manufacturers and everybody would move all their manufacturing east because they had much lower cost labor. And so suddenly there's a lot more truck traffic. At the same time, the European governments had tax policies which encouraged consumers to buy diesel-powered cars. If you've driven there, as I have often, and just this last December, you can rent a Mercedes there, and it gets 45 miles to the gallon. It's an E-Class Mercedes. It gets 45 miles to the gallon because it's running on diesel. So 60 to 70% of the new cars sold in Europe were diesel. They created this demand for diesel. European refiners make gasoline. They didn't make enough diesel. And it had to be low sulfur. Another point is, going back on this sulfur, historically, if you have higher sulfur diesel fuels, refiners can take blending fuels. When you refine, you get a diesel gas oil that's got some sulfur in it. If you refine very low sulfur crudes, you have no sulfur. If you refine an Arab light or something, you have some sulfur. And by blending, you can average the sulfur content. If you're aiming for 250 parts per million, it's easy. With 10 parts per million, it's not. David Teese, who teaches economics at Berkeley, once pointed out, it's like you make the mistake of putting a drop of cream in a cup of coffee. That if somebody likes black coffee, that cream's useless, and that coffee cup's useless. And that was the problem. So you wound up with that. We also had the Olympics last year and the growth in China. And Chinese demand for diesel fuel was growing rapidly. They used diesel fuel to power businesses because power supplies are irregular. It's like California was in 2000. And at the same time, the Chinese imposed price controls. So a number of smaller refineries shut down, and suddenly the Chinese were buying more diesel. So we created this huge demand. And so what happened was that we wound up exporting diesel fuel from the United States. We hadn't exported for 15 years. Suddenly we started to export. And if you just look at data from 1990 going forward to 2008, we'd averaged about 50,000 barrels a day of imports of distillates. Suddenly last year we were exporting at 150,000 barrels a day. I mean, the whole balance in the world changed. And you know, what happened in Europe is that the price of diesel fuel caught up with gasoline. If you'd been to Europe, you knew that diesel used to be lower. It was selling at about 90 cents. I think the Europeans call it cents. Instead, versus gasoline at 1.2 euros, so 0.9 euros. Well, the price went up because the European market was so tight and there was so much strength in the demand. Now, what happened was this then put the growth and the strength of the price of diesel put pressure on prices of white sweet crude. And so sweet crude prices started rising as gas oil pulled it up. And if you did a causality test, what you found is if you look at dated Brent, which is the sweet crude of record in the world, versus gas oil, which is the European version, gas oil being on the left because it's priced in dollars a metric ton, the two moved together, and gas oil was the driving factor from about August 06 to the peak. Then there were, we had an additional factor. Europe is the marginal market, so we teach you go to the margin to find the price, and the euro went from 1.3 to 1.6. Anybody who was in Europe last year in June or in the summer may recall it was real expensive there. It's now gone down dramatically. So what happened was the euro pulled up the European price of diesel in euros was setting the price. The euro strengthened. That pulled up crude prices. This need not have happened. We could have increased the supply of light sweet crude temporarily, because it was a temporary factor. And I testified to that effect last December, December 2007. What happened was that the U.S. government decided to add oil to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. in what I think was one of the greatest blunders of the Bush administration. Beginning in August 2007, the government decided to take some oil off the market and put it in the SPR. And the DOE people kept saying, oh, it's just a little. It's 30,000 barrels a day of sweet crude. Don't worry about it. It's minuscule in the world market. Well, that's 15,000 barrels a day of diesel fuel. And to replace it, you would have needed the incremental crude from Saudi Arabia, which is Arab heavy. You get 20 gallons of low sulfur diesel from sweet crude. You get less than a gallon of low sulfur diesel from Arab heavy once the refiner's units to desulfurize are full, and they were full. And so what we would have needed is 500,000 barrels a day of sour crude put on the market to maybe replace that. It didn't happen. Instead, prices went up. I laid out a case for in December when prices were 85, saying, yeah, we're going to go to 120 or 130 if adult supervision is not brought over DOE. Adult supervision was imposed in June when Congress passed a law ordering DOE to stop filling, and DOE stopped in July. It took them a month, and the prices fell. There was a couple other reasons. Another thing that happened is, if you go back, where does the light sweet crude come from? It's a country called Nigeria. And there's been a low-level civil war in Nigeria, and so we lost 100,000 barrels a day of production from Nigeria. Well, if you start, we only have 14 or 15 million barrels a day of supply of sweet crude in the world, and we lose 100,000 barrels a day, that loss in supply adds further to the price increase. Now, we're sitting on 250 million barrels of sweet crude in our U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The Europeans have like amounts, and you know, I had participated in the Ford administration and the Carter administration creating the SPR. This was a clear emergency. Prices had gone up. We could have used strategic petroleum reserves. But the answer was no. We look at the whole world as just a single crude market, and it's just a drop in the bucket. There was a lack of understanding, and that lack of understanding led to the high prices, and which helped us get along the way towards this recession, or worse. So you sit down and you say, okay, we have, you know, we really managed our way into this through environmental regulations that were inflexible. EPA and the Europeans could have allowed some flexibility on sulfur content. We could have done a number of other things. We didn't do any of it. Instead, we got the $147 crude. The question then becomes one of why did heavy crude not prices go down? Why did sour crude follow? And the answer is that the sour crude market is not a competitive market. The sour crude is managed by Saudi Arabia. Once a month, Saudi Arabia announces a discount or premium for its crudes versus a market crude. They quote a premium for crude going to Asia. They quote a premium for crude going to Europe, quote a premium for Europe going to the United States. Saudi Arabia does not allow resale of its crude, and none of the buyers who buy it resell it because essentially they want to keep doing business. And so Saudi Arabia adjusted the discount it was charging. Now, what happens is the Saudis tell firms about the first of the month, actually around the fourth, what the discount's going to be next month. So last December, they told buyers that the discount on Arab Heavy would be $10 a barrel. In January, they said, oh, we're going to cut the discount in February to $3 a barrel. And place your nominations. And so then they report buyers don't want as much crude. Buyers have reduced their nomination by 40%. And so they cut their production. This month, they said the discount for March is going to be 10 cents. And so buyers, again, cut their purchases. The other countries in OPEC follow this. Principally, it's Iran, Kuwait, use the same discounts. Now, why do you ask? Why don't they compete? Well, if you've ever looked at the diamond market, you'd understand. De Beers, what used to be the buyer to every seller and the seller to every buyer. They're the clearinghouse. And they quote a price to Tanzania. Tanzania would sell their diamonds to De Beers. Tanzania produced one kind of diamonds. At one point, Tanzania said, we're going to be smart. We can sell outside of De Beers. But De Beers also held a large inventory of the type of diamonds that Tanzania produced. De Beers dumped them on the market. The price fell by 60%. Tanzania said, maybe that wasn't such a good idea. Iran and Kuwait know what Saudi Arabia can do, so everybody follows. And what they do is essentially they hold the, so they hold their production. They use the same price quotes. They have an allocation of buyers that essentially worked out. The buyers agree not to resell the crude and take it to individual markets. Heavy crude oil is a crude oil that where you really have to design your refinery to process it. It's not like you, it's not just like a pressure cooker. It's a large version of a pressure cooker, but they're specialized pressure cookers for Arab heavy. You redesign your catalyst for Iran heavy. You redesign your catalyst. So oil, you know, it's best, you know, it's more profitable to refine the same kind of crude. So what happened was the Saudis this last year set their differentials, and for a while they tried to bring the price down. Then they gave up. And what you can see is that if you look at the difference in Arab heavy and WTI netbacks at the Gulf Coast versus the price differentials for the crudes, this is the margin. This is the profit a refiner would make. What you see is that they followed each other. The netback difference is the difference in the netback between the, it's the value of the products you get out of sweet crude versus the value of the products you get out of heavy crudes. That's the red line. The yellow line is the differential set by Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis watch the product markets and adjust their differentials and essentially work that way to control prices. So what happened was the Saudis essentially encouraged people to build surplus capacity. And if you look, following the monthly surplus capacity coming out of a publication called, or a group called Energy Intelligence Group, PIW, what we have is surplus capacity going from about 1 million barrels a day in 1997 at the left. We were operating at 4 million barrels a day last year through the whole time when prices were going up. That is, they were holding oil off the market to keep the price of heavy up versus light. Heavy crude prices didn't go down as they would have given these diesel rules because essentially this is the heavy market is not, or the sour market is not a competitive market. And what if you look at, if you look and compare that surplus to the movement of the price of dated Brent, you find in fact that every economists who go around and say, well, there was, you know, the reason prices went up was there's no surplus capacity, are dead wrong. I mean, there's absolutely no correlation really between this. The Saudis have built the surplus capacity up over the years whenever prices have been weak, but essentially this last year, it had nothing to do with surplus capacity. So moving, the question really is, you know, first, what are the Saudis trying to do? Well, they adjust their differentials to affect the level of OPEC output. And if you look and if you examine the data closely, what you find is looking at OPEC crude output going from 23 to 33 million barrels a day versus the price spread, as the Saudis adjust their price spreads, they cause OPEC output to go up and down. You know, you can read press reports saying that, well, the OPEC maybe is cutting production, maybe not. What they do is they essentially set the differentials and let the buyers reduce their nominations. It's not a question of really going out and saying we're going to produce less and have people compete for the volumes. You know, my story is quite simple. It was sweet crude. It was in our environmental regulations. And it was a colossal policy blunder at the Bush administration not to release sweet crude from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. That could have it was easily possible to keep crude prices at $70 a barrel. So we could have avoided what worked out to be a $1 trillion tax on the world economy, which is 2% of GDP, which I think had some macro effects, maybe a lot of macro effects. We're going to repeat the experiment. We're going to get much higher crude prices again. If you go back to that graph, 2020 or something like that, probably sooner, because we are moving to a new set of environmental regulations. And since the environmental regulators have not had to bear any of the blame for the price increase, they're going to do it to us again. Where they're going to do it to us is in an area that's going to affect international trade, big time. You look at California, you look at the Port of Long Beach, you look at Los Angeles, you look at your relationship to Asia. They're going to, you know, their new actions could really put a crimp on global trade. How? by essentially requiring the removal of sulfur from the fuels used on ships. Right now, I talk about diesel trucks using 10 parts per million, and most of you can remember when trucks belched out black smoke. They don't anymore. Ships, the maximum sulfur in diesel fuel sold to ship owners right now is 4.5%. The International Maritime Organization, which governs this, it's a UN NGO, has required the standard be cut to 0.5% sulfur by 2020, with a review in 2018 to see if this is practical. The U.S., they've also granted a waiver so that areas where there's a lot of concern about pollution can go more rapidly. The U.S. is issuing rules that we have to be down to about 0.5% sulfur by the end of 2010 within a 200-mile distance of the United States. Canadians, I think, are going to love this because that means that all the ships on the Great Lakes have to use low sulfur. It also applies in the North Sea. The Europeans are doing the same thing. So suddenly we're going to essentially require the removal of most sulfur from fuels used on ships. The International Energy Agency experts who study refining say it's probably not practical for refiners to to invest in enough desulfurization capacity. And given the low margin on refining right now, if you read the financial press, firms like Tesoro and so on aren't going to make the investment. So what's going to happen is there's not going to be enough fuel available, and we're going to have another bidding war for sweet crudes. That'll take the price up. That then could bring us another economic cycle. The real tragedy is that if ever there were a case for resolving this, this is it. Because you can put a desulfurization unit on a ship. It's not that big. Take the sulfur out, burn the high sulfur product, and then and essentially emit no SO2. You can take out you can scrub the fuel, you can scrub the exhaust, and take out the NOx, so that it's perfectly possible to move forward without imposing such draconian regulations on the fuel use. But the environmental regulators, particularly in this new administration, are almost certainly going to go the other direction, particularly if they don't understand that they were as much at fault. Their regulations on diesel and the inflexibility of their diesel regulations were as much at fault for the rise in prices to $147 and part of the economic recession that followed as any other cause. So you sit here and somebody came in and say, well, where are crude prices going to go? And the answer is they're going to go back up. Now, I'll conclude with two lines from literature. First is, I just finished something and I realized that the Song of the April, Ancient Mariner had a great line, water, water everywhere, narrow drop to drink. Well, last year we had crude oil everywhere, but we couldn't get any diesel out of it. The other is that Matt Simmons wrote a very good book called, Twilight in the Desert. Talked about how Saudi Arabia was running out of productive capacity and that was going to lead to much higher prices. Came out about 3 years ago. Timing's everything. He was all over the television talking about how, the rise in oil prices this last year was due to peak oil. And we were going to see high oil prices from here on to come. And he's got a new piece out saying they're going to go back up very quickly. Reading that, you look at this and say, well, there's a double entendre. He meant twilight in the sense it's the end of the career, Frank Sinatra's song and so on. But twilight's also the end of the day, and dawn follows night. Dawn follows twilight. And low oil prices follow high oil prices, just as dawn follows the dusk. And we also know that there's a rhythm to this, a circadian rhythm, and dusk does follow the dawn. So we're going to see high oil prices again, probably much sooner than we did in the past due to these environmental regulations. And no doubt what will happen is if they go into effect and if it becomes much more expensive to ship, we see the same effect as we saw this last year. Suddenly, it doesn't pay to manufacture in China. It pays to bring the manufacturing over here. So China goes into recession. Economic growth slows in Asia. Economic growth slows here because of high oil prices. We have a recession. And then oil prices come back down. And the real tragedy is that we are building in more frequent cycles. And if this recession lasts as long as Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff think it's going to, if you read, and they have a fabulous paper out on this, we're looking at probably 2010 or late 2010 before we get to economic recovery of any sort. And just about the time we come out, we'll have these new regulations raising oil prices again, and that could prolong this thing for another 4 or 5 years. Let me stop there. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. I guess my question with crude dropping as sharply as it is, it's a rather simple one that affects the average consumer. Why are gas prices going up still?
Well, first, WTI has, the price that we focus on is West Texas Intermediate. That price has been artificially depressed. I've spent a long part of my career writing and studying the arcane subject of commodity markets. And what has happened is periodically you get investors who decide to do something with futures markets that distort futures markets. And in this case, there is a fund called the U.S. Crude Oil Fund that's taking very large positions in futures contracts that expire within, say, 45 days. That their actions are essentially driving prices down for a very peculiar reason having to do with the way the markets work. So the base crude oil price is much higher. It's something like $45 a barrel. It's $42 today. And so if you measure the price of gasoline versus this higher price of crude oil, what you find is that the gasoline prices are closer to being what you'd expect. Second, refiners haven't been making any money. Years ago, in the early 90s, I was asked to be on the Valero board, and I was on it for 3 years. When I joined the board, one of my friends told me, look, Phil, what you have to understand is refining is a very cyclical business. You get to make profits 1 year out of 10. Refiners had a fabulous year in 2007, and everybody wrote about the refining era. Well, something happened. And refining margins are terrible now. Two refiners are in bankruptcy. Another refiner, I think, will go into bankruptcy. And what happened is that suddenly the demand for their product, gasoline, went down. Why? Well, in November 2007, the Congress passed a law that Bush had asked for, raising the amount of ethanol you had to use. That took roughly 10% of the refiner's gasoline market away. Beginning January 1, 2008. The law requires using so much ethanol. And this is business that's profitable when capacity is really tight, becomes less profitable when there's any surplus capacity. So I think refining operating rates are now around 83%. And you can't make money at 83%. Diesel prices were holding up. The margins were fabulous on those for a while. We exported a lot of diesel. That's gone away. So essentially, they're not making much money. They have shut down a lot of refining capacity. And as you shut refining capacity down and you don't push it as hard, that reduces supply. So supply and demand and gasoline prices go up. But it's crude, and it's the cutback in refinery utilization. And the concern these guys, frankly, have about bankruptcy.
Thank you very much, sir, for a very clear and edifying presentation. Do you know what percentage worldwide of refineries are tooled to eliminate sulfur, and what happens to the waste product?
All refineries have some capacity to remove sulfur, and they're building a lot more. Years ago, we worried about the mountains of sulfur that were going to develop. You can picture them in the desert. And I hadn't followed that for a long time, but I remember reading an article recently that there is a, not surprisingly, sulfur was very cheap, and so there's now a large market for the sulfur, and I'm not quite sure what they're doing with it, but it is being consumed, so that has not become a problem. The problem is that it's just, refiners face two problems. One, it's extremely expensive to make a refinery, a hydrotreating refinery. Hydrotreating, what we have over in the United States are what are called cracking refineries, FCC refineries, which are basically gasoline manufacturing plants. Hydrotreating refineries make a lot of diesel, low sulfur diesel, and they're much more expensive to build, and so it takes a long time, it takes a lot of capital, $3 to $5 billion a copy. And there are a couple under construction, they're being delayed. It would help if the Saudis would let the price of heavy crude go down and make it profitable. But, you know, the Saudis are building the capacity, and I think their view is we'll control all the hydrotreating capacity in the world. And I would if I were Saudi, too. But as for the sulfur, I'm not sure where it's going. I just remember there is a market, and it's being consumed. And it's a good question. Next time somebody asks, I'll have an answer.
You alluded briefly to the development of biofuels, and I wondered if you could expand on that as we see an expansion of the biofuel industry around the world. And secondly, and related, increased automobile mileage and shifting to hybrids and other forms of transportation having an impact on the crude pricing around the world?
Good questions. Let me go in the reverse order. We were talking earlier, Professor Hamilton was noting that China's now selling more cars than we are. One of the things that is United States auto market saturated, European auto market saturated. So when essentially you're selling new cars, you're replacing a less efficient car with a more efficient car, and that reduces consumption a little bit. The Chinese market's not saturated, so every time you sell a new Chinese car, almost every time, you have one more car on the road because the capital stock is very low and it's growing rapidly. So what's going to happen is I think motor fuel consumption will move from Europe, from the U.S. to Asia. And assuming this recession is not catastrophic for Asia, you won't have that big a drop off. I think my numbers suggest oil consumption 2 years from now are going to be about 7 or 8% below what consumption was this last year. Now, that is within the ability of the Saudis to manage the market, particularly given the way fields are falling. That keeps you in a price of $35 to $50. Biofuels are another thing. If you look at the requirements in the Energy Security Act of 2007, you essentially see that the replacement of gasoline will require that U.S. refining production of gasoline go from 9 million barrels a day approximately last year to about 4 million barrels a day by 2017, 2018. Because there's such a huge biofuels requirement. I don't think it's achievable. You can't transport biofuels in our existing petroleum product pipeline systems because of the water they carry. If you did, you'd have problems with diesel fuel, and more importantly, you'd have problems with jet fuel. Water and jet fuel is a no-no because of the what happens when you get up into high altitudes and the water freezes. So I don't know how we're going to resolve that problem. The chemists are working at various oil companies, and I'm sure here, trying to figure out how you can convert various biofuels into essentially long-chain hydrocarbons such as butanol, which is a blending stock. Biobutanol becomes ideal, or if you can make a biobutanol out of it, you get a biofuel, you put it, you blend it in at the refinery, there's no water in it, and it handles perfectly. But, DuPont and BP haven't broken that, and they've thrown a hell of a lot of money at that problem, because the person who solves that problem is going to do very well. My guess is we're still going to push it. Mostly because of the trading system, it'll be in the Midwest. We'll see up E80 fuels that are entirely butanol based in the Midwest and in parts of Europe and so on, where you can get the fuels there easily and solve the transportation problems. Places like California, particularly given the South Coast air quality problems, I think we'll back away from it just because of the pollution characteristics.
Can you tell us something about the situation in Mexico and Venezuela, falling oil price, oil production? And what the forecast is and what the effect of that will be?
I think it's pretty obvious what's going to happen in Venezuela. Hugo Chavez has used oil as a mechanism for social programs. That ain't going to happen. He's going to be forced to cut back. How that plays out is something for the political scientists to examine. Yeah. I'm no better position than you are to predict that. Mexico is going to have to come to a conclusion about having foreign investors. There is a large oil field in Mexico we share with Mexico that's on the border between Texas and Mexico. Offshore, it's deep water. Chevron's developing it right now. We have an agreement not to go in and essentially drain the field. That agreement expires in a year. It's sweet crude. Logically, what Mexico needs to do is to essentially change its constitution so that offshore, you know, it can enter into deals with the major oil companies to develop the offshore fields, the deep Cantrell and so on, because they do not have the technology and because the companies with the capital aren't going to invest on a service basis there. Now, there are people like Schlumberger and others that go around, but essentially, if you look at the major operators, Exxon, Chevron, Shell, BP, the firms that operate in the deep water areas, they do it themselves, they want the profitability, and they have plenty of opportunities. I think the real interesting case is going to be Brazil, which is sitting on a huge field in the Atlantic that's very deep. Petrobras has become a much better oil company. But if you look at it with low oil prices, where are they going to get the capital? And there's one company that's sitting around with, cash assets of something like $40 billion and stock in its treasury worth, somebody said, half a trillion dollars. That's Exxon, which could, if given the right opportunity, go in and develop it. But it's, you know, until Mexico breaks with its constitution, its production is going to go down. I mean, they need capital, they need this talent, and the companies don't do it on a service basis. And the logical company to really develop is Exxon, and Exxon has a just plain, they do say no.
What's the difference in demand for crude by ships versus crude by motor vehicles, and will that difference in demand have any impact on this 2012-2020 price spike?
I wish the answer were no. I wish it were small, but I think the answer is that ocean-going ships consume, and I've tried to get this data, and it's hard to get a good number, something on the order of 6 or 7% of the world's consumption of oil. It is a big number. And you look at how much, you know, that when they fill the tanks on one of these ships, my memory is they put 50,000 to 75,000 barrels of oil in the ship. It's just, you think about it, you're moving a big, heavy thing at pretty good speed through the water and the friction and everything else. They need a lot of oil.
How did the different forms of transportation break down in terms of percentage, you know, as far as world trade is concerned? And in the U.S. in particular, what would be your outlook for the expanded use of natural gas to power vehicles?
Well, that's a good question. I focus on prices almost entirely and not on market shares because the quantity data are so poor. Natural gas offers a real alternative. There are some questions about where you can, using LNG in trucks has always been a great idea. The question is, do you allow a truck with an LNG tank to go through a tunnel? Because if it blows up, you've got a serious problem. Compressed natural gas is a lot; they don't seem to have a problem. But that is one of those the technological changes. The big impediment is, of course, delivery of the gas. If you drive up, we used to drive between South Coast and Colorado all the time. We had a house there, and then we moved to Colorado. In Utah, they have a lot of compressed natural gas at the gasoline stations. If you tie your gasoline stations in so that you have compressed natural gas and you price it properly, people will change. I mean, the European experience is offer lower taxes for diesel, and everybody will buy a diesel-powered vehicle. You offer a slightly lower tax for natural gas-powered vehicles, people will buy them if they can get the natural gas, certainly for a commuting vehicle. But if you're going to go to natural gas on a nationwide basis, you need a fueling system across the country. And you know, that's an infrastructure. That's a big infrastructure issue. You have to somehow get people who own service stations, and they're not the major oil companies anymore. They're independent businessmen to put that in, which means that you really have to offer some sort of incentive or some sort of regulation. We once faced that problem in the early 70s when we switched to unleaded gasoline. And what EPA did was require that every gasoline station sell unleaded gasoline, even though there was no demand. And the threat was a very large fine if you ran out. And you had to close if you didn't have it. I suppose they could do something like that. So the answer is we could shift. It's not going to be quick. It makes a lot of sense. It's cleaner. And California is an ideal place because you have the gas pipeline system in here and everything, and you could build a fueling system up like Utah's pretty quickly, but it really takes some initiative, and it takes money.
I have a couple of questions, and a few assumptions which might be wrong that are based on these, but it seems to me that oil is a depleting resource regardless of the strategic reserve, which will certainly affect the price short term, as will environmental controls. And it seems to me that oil sands are expensive, use a lot of natural gas. LNG is expensive. Transporting gas is expensive. You can't clean coal cheaply. And so it seems to me, and tell me if I'm wrong or why I'm wrong, that over 10, 15, 20-year periods, it's going to cost more than $3 or $5 a barrel to extract oil. Horizontal drilling is expensive, and it's going to get more expensive. Am I on a real basis, not over 2 years? I have no idea, but over 10, 15, 20 years. Am I wrong? Is it always going to have the same real price in our lifetimes, I guess?
Well, when I had color in my hair, did everybody hear the question? Okay. Okay. It's the question is why, it's cost of producing oil is going to go up, and so the price has to go up.
And demand will go up.
The demand will go up. Well, first question is prices go up, demand adjusts. And although I started doing price elasticity studies, and the price elasticity was low, and Professor Hamilton finds that they've gone down, which I think is right, in the short term. In the longer term, consumers respond pretty quickly. I mean, look at all the hybrids, look at the diesels. When I had color in my hair, and I was giving these talks in the early 70s, I got the same questions, and I fell for the bait. And the fact of the matter is that what we have in this business is a one where you develop capacity, it's expensive, your marginal cost is higher. Once you've got the capacity on stream, you don't shut it down, and so the price falls. And so, if you were talking in 1860 or 1865, you start with my first graph, and everybody says, well, our costs are going up. It may be that prices will go up and stay up. History, 150 years of history suggest that ain't the case. It's a case where the prices go up, people push very hard, they develop alternatives and so on, natural gas, more rail, and the price, or economic recessions come, and the prices come back down. And so, I know a lot of companies that produce oil that are facing bankruptcy right now because they didn't hedge properly. But they're still producing. They're not going to shut their production down. They need the cash flow. I have read the peak oil studies. You read them. You look at declining reserves. You go across the story. I think basically my answer is what happens is the price will go up, and you'll get a good heart, and what will happen is income transfer starts to the Middle East. The global economy is $50 trillion. $45 trillion. We stuck it with a $1 trillion tax over the 12 months from August 07 to August 08. That $1 trillion tax had some huge macro impacts. Economic growth slowed. The income transfer went to the Middle East. So the economic growth slowed. Suddenly, there's plenty of surplus capacity. So what happens is, yes, costs go up. Prices go up. You get the income transfer. You're going to get another recession. It may be that until we figure out how to deal with this, we have a more secular, down cycles, and the economic outlook's worse. I don't see that those prices are sustainable. They haven't been for 150 years. I find it hard to see them being sustainable in the future.
I have two questions, both relating to peak oil and one relating to economic model. DeFaze and Simmons both claim that all of the major oil fields of the world have already topped out. Gawar, they claim, topped out in 2005. Cantarell topped out a year ago, February. Production was down 15%. So if it is a finite supply, I'd be interested in your comments about when it does hit that Hubbert peak and start on the way down, what are going to be the economic implications of that? And the other one is DeFaze thinks that possibly queuing theory may be a better model to look at this. We're looking at it as a linear economic model, but if you no longer can draw up more supply and demand by increasing price because there is no more supply, you're probably going to be faced with queuing theory, which is a nonlinear dynamic situation, and you could end up with 10-to-1 fluctuations in prices. I would be interested in your comment on those two issues.
Well, let me take the queuing theory first. I haven't read the paper. Economists look at the peak oil theory, scratch their heads. What is clear, Maury Edelman, one of my teachers, wrote this years ago, that what happens is prices go up, you find more, and you get more conservation, you get more substitution. And that's the answer. So, I mean, the prices, we will see higher prices. You may use less. Zaki Yamani got it exactly right when he said the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. And the oil age ain't going to end because we ran out of oil. I mean, economics works. We will find a solution. And as regards price peaks, I think that's right. I mean, as I said, we're going to get price peaks. I think it's going to be caused by environmental regulations. So I think that, this last one wasn't caused because we were running out of oil. There's plenty of oil. We just couldn't use it. And the same thing's true for going to be true going forward with ships. But suppose it were that we didn't have the production capacity. Suppose we exhausted all that production capacity. Then prices would go up. That puts the brake on demand. The quicker break comes on macroeconomic activity because of the nature of commodity markets. I mean, oil's no different, hasn't been any different in the last 30 years than corn or any of the other physical commodities like copper. You push yourself to the limit and suddenly the price doesn't go up by 5%, it goes up by 35%. And whether you explain it by queuing theory or other kinds of economic models, and I've read lots of models for different kinds of commodities, same thing will happen.
In the spring of 2005, we were in Brazil. We were there for 2 weeks. We did a lot of driving around. Some of the fueling stations had both types of fuel, the biofuel from the sugarcane and regular gasoline. And the driver used to like to fill up as much as he could when it became low with the biofuel because it was cheaper. My question has to do with sustainability in Brazil. Will they be able to continue to be successful in what they've achieved?
The answer is I don't know. But Brazil is blessed both with a lot of land. It's tragic what they've done with the rainforest, but a lot of land that grows these soybeans. Some of it's rich, some of it's going to get peter out pretty quickly. It's also blessed with this huge oil find off the in the Atlantic, I haven't tried to find out how big it is. My judgment on it is it probably ranks with Cantarell, and the Saudis that I talked with in London a few weeks ago think it may even rank with Galwar. But it is so deep and under the water, it's so hard to get at that they're just beginning to tap it. I mean, subsalt, when I first started this, you had no way of finding it using sonar detection systems. I mean, that's the progress. And this is one of the reasons why we keep moving forward, is we had getting the technologies moved ahead. So I just don't know. I think the Brazilians have done a good job of moving towards what they had. You know, they use sugarcane for ethanol. We ought to be using sugarcane for ethanol because it's, you know, I don't understand the science well, but it's pretty clearly a better feedstock. So, I mean, you lay that out, and that's one of the ways we should be going forward. I wish I could answer the question. I don't know. The other question is, what happens to the global economy? Brazil thought they were going to be exempt from this recession. They're not going to be. Everybody thought that it was just going to be the United States that was going to have the recession. Everybody's going to have a worse recession than we are, and Brazil's going to be hard hit. So they're going to get another 5 to 10 years to plan ahead. Let's go over here. And then I guess this is going to have to be the last question. Yeah.
Could you explain what you mean by flexibility in environmental regulation?
Yeah. We have a set of hard rules. If diesel fuel in the United States, when it gets to the truck right now, has to be 15 parts per million. CARBOB, the California gas, has certain formulas. If you make a fuel, if you have a problem with the refinery and you can't quite make the product meeting these standards, you can't sell it. For years, economists have been arguing that we ought to have pollution penalties. That is, if you sell something that's got a little more sulfur in it, you pay a slightly higher tax. And so that you'll, and Severin Bornstein, who teaches at Berkeley, has argued for a long time that California could avoid some of these problems it has with its refineries if it had this flexibility where the producer paid a higher tax, and this would provide an incentive for refiners not to make a mistake, but if they had a problem, the fuel would be available. And if you have that kind of flexibility in your pricing system, you can have as clean an environment, but you can have you have more flexibility in the fuel supply, so you don't have as high prices. One way to think about this is in cap and trade. I've written a lot about futures markets over the years, and I know a lot about them. And one of the problems you have in a commodity futures market is if you run out of inventory, prices go very high because you can't tap your future inventory. You know, if you're out of corn and there's a big corn crop, it doesn't do you any good until you harvest the corn crop. And if it's July, it's too early to harvest it. You can go into a cap and trade system where you sell futures, where you have a futures market on pollution permits, and you don't run into that barrier. If you're allowed to sell your future permits at, say, a premium, so that if suddenly right now we don't have enough CO2 premium permits, we sell the 2010 permit, somebody can sell some of his 2010 permits at a premium, you can then hit the supply, and so the cost doesn't suddenly go from 10 to 100. And you can avoid these price perturbations, and these price perturbations are the big macro impacts. So, you know, that's what I'm talking about. It's flexibility with taxes in the permitting process. But, you know, that's for another day. Thank you very much.
Wait, very interesting talk and some great questions. Join me in thanking Dr. Philip.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.